This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Turmeric Liposome Complex, a natural solution to chronic pain. Future Farm's liquid turmeric with liposomes and nanotechnology delivers maximum absorption for effective pain relief. Sourced and manufactured in the United States, this product contains 1,600 milligrams of curcumin and powerful antioxidant properties. This plant-based curcumin is used to possibly reduce inflammation, block proteins that trigger swelling, and intercept inflammatory pathways, significantly decreasing inflammatory responses. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Don't live with pain when there's an all-natural, science-based remedy that works without adverse side effects. Get free shipping on all of your orders at myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and my next guest, I'm very much looking forward to talking to her, may hold the secret to our current epidemics that are plaguing Western society. And no, she's not an inventor of a new heart procedure. She doesn't have a breakthrough cancer cure. She's going to help us attack the problem at its source, which is childhood nutrition. You know, we're seeing a tremendous upsurge in childhood obesity. We're seeing children with type 2 diabetes, which used to be unprecedented. And kids are eating badly, and part of it is a toxic food environment. This podcast is especially targeted for you parents out there and you grandparents. Today we're going to talk to Dr. Dina Rose. Dr. Rose is a PhD sociologist. She's a parent educator. She's a feeding expert. That's a very unique moniker. And she's the author of a book called It's Not About the Broccoli, Three Habits to Teach Your Kids for a Lifetime of Healthy Eating. She's been training parents, pediatricians, dietitians, and early childhood educators in the habits approach for the past decade. And we're going to find out all about it. It's a unique way of getting kids to eat right. So it's a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Rose. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, so let's, first of all, intriguing title to your book is not about the broccoli. I mean, of course it's about the broccoli. It's like, eat the broccoli, eat the broccoli. What's the matter with you? You're not eating the broccoli. Come on, give it a try. It's we'll put some Kraft melted cheese on it.
That's right, exactly. You know, it's not about the broccoli for a couple of reasons. One is that with the nutrition mindset that we have in our culture, like we're so focused on figuring out which foods have which nutrients and what's good for you and what's bad for you. And when we put our energy there, all we do is put our energy on food. Like we know more about food and we know more and more about food and then we know more and more and more about food, but we really don't know how to get our kids to eat that food. So in that regard, it's not about the broccoli because we got to focus on the dynamic of teaching our children, of interacting with our children around the food. And so what I really mean about it's not about the broccoli is teaching children about eating habits is about focusing on habits, not nutrition. And it's also about focusing on how we interact with our kids around food, because so much of the time we're doing things that we mean well, that our doctors sometimes tell us to do, that the media tells us to do, but it can backfire in unintentional ways. And so it's really got to be focused on the parent-child dynamic and about how we teach kids and what we teach kids rather than on the food.
Well, give us some examples of the backfire of what seems to be constructive and responsible parenting. But ultimately reinforces bad eating choices by kids.
Yeah, the easiest example is to look at the advice to just, if your kid likes broccoli, give your kid broccoli every night, right? Because that's vegetable. That's getting vegetables and minerals, whatever, into your kid. Well, if we give our child the same food every single day, or even give them food that kind of looks like each other, like if we do mac and cheese and grilled cheese and cheese sticks and cheese quesadillas, which are all sort of like and, you know, cheese pasta. Like, they're all sort of approximately the same food in the sense that they have the same texture and they have the same mouthfeel and they have the same experience.
Chicken fingers is a big one, I think.
Yeah, but what we're doing is teaching our kids to expect monotony, not to expect variety. Mm-hmm. And most of us do this. Like, we settle on a handful of breakfast foods, a handful of lunch foods, a handful of snack foods. Then dinner comes along. It's what I call, like, the big daddy of the day. And we mix it up. And so when you talk to parents, the time that they're having the struggle is dinner. So they're worrying about dinner. But they're setting dinner up for the struggle. They're setting dinner up for the struggle by teaching their kids that most of the time you eat a monotonous diet. So they're reinforcing the mindset. They're reinforcing the taste and the taste preferences and the expectations. And then, and they're also saving the vegetables for dinner. And then they're setting up dinner to have so much impact because that's where the vegetables matter. And we've already taught our kids expect monotony, not variety. So if we put that, if we just switch that around, and we say to ourselves as parents, not how do I get the right nutrients into our kids, but how do I teach my child about variety? How do I teach my child to expect variety? One thing we can do before we've even got a great eater is what I call the rotation rule, which is simply this. Just deliberately rotate the foods that you're feeding your child so that no food shows up 2 days in a row. And you can do this just with the foods that your child already eats. This is not about new foods. One of the big mistakes parents make is that we sometimes think that new foods have to be the definition of variety, but variety just means different, right? Mm-hmm. So implement the rotation rule with the foods your kids already eat, and you will be teaching them the mindset to expect variety. That will actually lay the foundation for new food exploration.
Do kids actually have different taste buds than adults? Because I know for me personally, there was foods that I abhorred as a child, and now I find them quite delectable. It's not just a matter of psychology that I was a willful child, which I was, you know, trying to control my parents through what, you know, I was rejecting. But it really, kids have different taste buds, don't they?
Well, sure. I mean, there is research out there that shows that children, first of all, are sort of come out of the chute, so to speak, with a preference for sweeter foods and fattier foods that approximate like what breast milk is like. There's research that shows that children have like more taste buds than adults do. Mm-hmm. And of course, some kids are like extra sensitive and super tasters and all those kinds of things.
So they're more attuned to bitter tastes, perhaps. And maybe there's an evolutionary reason for that because, you know, kids are more susceptible to poisoning and toxicity. And maybe that's a built-in protective mechanism so that many poisonous plants do have bitter tastes.
Sure, that could be true, and I'm not discounting that, but we have to put that into context, which is if all kids across the world have those same sort of biological genetic predispositions, then how do we explain that Indian kids eat Indian food and Mexican kids eat Mexican food and American kids eat hot dogs, right? So it is true, and then that they do come, and some kids come predisposed to being adventurous eaters, some kids come predisposed to being more cautious eaters. So we do have this whole mix, and it's one of the things that makes it extra challenging. But the thing that we can't deny is that it's a learning experience. So even if your child has a predisposition to not liking certain kinds of flavors or textures, then the way to solve the problem is not to say, oh, well, my child doesn't like crunchy food or my child doesn't like bitter food, for instance, and therefore I can't serve those foods. Mm-hmm. The solution is to work towards greater acceptance, not to the point where we have to make every kid like every food. That's not the goal. But the goal has got to be that we understand that this is about exposure, how often we expose our kids to different flavors. It's about teaching them to enjoy different flavors. It's about teaching them how to get more of those exposures under their belt. So here's another one that causes problems. There's all that research that shows that kids need to be exposed to food, you know, like whatever, 10 times, 12 times, 15 times. You know, if you're a parent in the trenches, that might as well be a million times, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's just no way you're going to get that number of exposures. But there are a couple things going on here. One is that if we think, let's just take the number 10 to make it easy. Mm-hmm. That, and by the way, the research shows that different kinds of foods require different amounts of encouragement and exposure. But let's just take 10.
Okay.
If you knew that your child was guaranteed not to like a food until the 10th try, we would go into top tries 1 through 9 with a different expectation. Mm-hmm. We would go into those exposures thinking, well, all I have to do is get a sniff or a feel or a taste or a little bit of an exposure because we're waiting to get to number 10. We wouldn't expect our child to eat the food, and they certainly wouldn't expect to eat a whole portion of the food. Mm-hmm. And yet parents, this is what we do in practice in our homes, right? We create this new dish. We say to ourselves, I know it's going to take, you know, 10, 15 times for Sammy to like, you know, carrots. But we get to number 5, the research shows, and we stop trying. And mm-hmm. the reason is because I go to the trouble to prepare this meal.
Right.
And you reject it.
Yeah.
And I am pissed off and I'm sick and tired of throwing out food.
Yeah.
Maybe I can't afford to throw out food. Yeah. And I just give up.
Could that also underlie issues around food security? You know, poorer individuals can't afford a lot of experimentation. They can't, you know, get a whole bottle, a whole package of arugula and then throw out the vast majority of it 10 times. So they're sort of sticking to the basics, you know, just providing adequate calories. And they're just happy that the kids are eating something. And
yes.
It's cheap food, you know, cheap, palatable food.
Yes, if you can't afford to throw out food, you can't afford to experiment with meals. But here's the thing that I'm trying to get at, which is if we switch our mindset to how do we teach our children to like a wide variety of foods and flavors and textures, when they're little, we think about this as if we're teaching a skill. So we think about how do we teach kids to read. We don't sit down and expect them to open up a book. We teach them letter recognition, and then we teach them about how the sounds are associated with letters, and then they practice putting them together, and then they look at words, and eventually they get sentences, and one day they get books. This takes a long time. We expect it to be an incremental skill set that they're working on. And with food, we think we should be able to just plunk it down, mm-hmm. and they should just dive right in.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah.
When we switch our mindset, food exploration, there is science supporting that the only way that we can reliably reduce or eliminate picky eating, which is just a more severe, obvious case of what all kids are going through when they're worried about new foods. The only way to reliably sort of combat that is to teach children the skills of exploration, which happens through their senses. So it's sensory education and exploration. So all of us, whether you have plenty of money to throw away food because you shouldn't be throwing it away, or you don't really have any money, that arugula, it is way better for all of us to get a leaf of arugula, which you can do at a salad bar, or you can do if you're eating an arugula salad or something like that. We take a leaf and we show it to our kids. We might, the first time, we might just look at it. We might crinkle it. We might smell it. We might do a lot of things, but that's the education around arugula. Mm-hmm. And the next time when we're doing some other kind of lettuce or even something that's not lettuce, we might say, remember how green that was? How green is this and which compares and what's it like? And, mm-hmm. and we're doing it with a pea-sized sample. And that, the research shows, does so many things, but it helps kids primarily build up a database of food facts that they can then use to predict what a food will be like the next time they encounter it or the 10th time that they encounter it. And that's what's really important because they're making a decision by looking at the food and saying, is this something that I think that I'm going to enjoy? The other thing I want to say about that is that it eliminates pressure, and pressure is the dynamic that is really harmful. Mm-hmm. And it does one other thing. It stops parents from using the most popular phrase in America, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the most dreaded phrase in America. And it's this: just taste it. If you don't like it, you don't have to eat it.
Sounds pretty innocuous to me.
Right, exactly. Why would that be such a dreaded phase that I'm willing to, you know, mark that as the big evil?
I could see an automatic no coming, though, right? You know, because it's you know, that this is the age where kids are sort of expressing their willfulness, and they don't have a lot of control. They don't have a lot of control over, you know, even the clothes they wear. They don't have control over a lot of things, but they can control what goes into their mouths, and that's a pretty important basic element of control.
Yes, so there's definitely an element of control going on, but here's the other thing that really makes it the dreaded phrase, which I should give it an award or something. I don't know if we could think of an award, but anyway, because it teaches children to say, I don't like it.
Yeah.
Because the only legal way out of eating food.
It's very binary. It's very binary. It's like, exactly. You know, plus or minus. Yeah. There's no middle ground. I see your point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's so, and not only that. So if they don't want to eat it, they say, I don't like it.
Right.
If they're not feeling like it, they say, I don't like it. If it looks weird to them, they say, I don't like it.
Right.
And then once it's in their I don't like it basket, not only will they not try it a second or a third time, but parents start thinking, oh, she doesn't like it.
Yeah.
And personally, as an adult, if you knew, okay, I do not, here's the truth, I do not like blue cheese. And if you were providing me with food after a couple of times, you would start thinking, like, I don't want to give it to her because I hate when people make me eat things mm-hmm. that I don't like. Mm-hmm. So as the parent, we start saying, oh, well, you know, Jill doesn't like blue cheese. I'm not serving blue cheese. And it could well be, first of all, that she hasn't been exposed to it enough times, but it could also be that she's using language to get what she wants. And what we need to do is to change the way our kids talk about food. Mm-hmm.
Break down the barriers, because there are actually categories and linguistics, that kids glom onto, and they like sort of a stereotyped behavior, and regular habits.
Yes, but also they're told that there's no room to say that looks gross or, ooh, that looks weird. And there's all sorts of research that shows, for instance, in one study that was done a number of years ago in England, a child thought that a cauliflower looked like a sheep's brain. There is a very popular video going around the internet right now where there's a little child being asked to eat Sloppy Joe, and the child is refusing and crying and saying, like, it looks like poop. And the mother keeps laughing and saying, no, 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 it's Sloppy Joe, it's Sloppy Joe. And if you think about this poor child, like, the words it's Sloppy Joe doesn't actually mean anything if I've never had Sloppy Joe. I'm having a reaction to the food, and it disgusts me. And we don't give our kids any room to tell us those things. And so, you know, that, like, don't yuck on my yum, and don't be rude. Like, if you don't like it, keep it to yourself.
Right.
Like, there's all this, I get it, right? Okay, I want my child to be polite just as much as the next person. And I'll tell you, as a chef, if I've labored and you tell me you don't like something, or you go, I'm going to get offended because I have a thin skin. But the real thing here is that if we tell our kids that the only acceptable response is the positive response, then we're making them deal with their negative responses themselves. That's one thing. And second of all, they're going to rely more ardently on the words, I don't like it. And it's going to make it much more difficult for us to get over it. So a couple of things. One is that if we stop asking our kids, do you like it? Like, just take a bite, and if you don't like it, you don't have to eat it. Because also the kid is thinking, well, if I do like it, I will have to eat it. And we're thinking, if you like it, don't you want to eat it? And he's thinking, no, I don't want to eat it even if I like it. So that happens. But if we stop saying that and say, even if we say taste it, if you just taste it and tell me, is it crunchy? Or just taste it and tell me if it's smushy? Or just taste it and tell me if you think I need to add more salt? Or if we change the question and the request, then kids eliminate that, the whole thing about I don't like it. And it also engages them in the ability to interact with that food, you know, taste it or squish it or do whatever a second time, a fourth time, an eighth time, right? Because we haven't put it in a do not like it box.
It seems there's a couple of basic problems with childhood eating behavior. There's, of course, the finicky eater, and I think that's maybe the majority of kids, but there's also the overeater, you know, the kid who's like the chow hound. You know, he's constantly looking for more food and maybe making the wrong choices. What do you do about that kind of kid? Do you just say, all right, we're done. You know, I'm putting the food away in the refrigerator. The kid starts screaming and you just let him, whatever, farberize is the term. You know, you just...
Right, for the sleep training. Yeah, just let him cry it out.
Yeah, let him cry it out.
Yeah. No, don't do that. Because here's another thing. Let's think about kids who overeat. There's a couple of different reasons for overeating and we have to deal with them separately. One of the reasons that kids are overeating is because we have a cultural ethic in our society that children need to eat every 2 to 3 hours and they have to have snacks.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not that's actually scientifically proven is a whole separate question because there's never been any science to show mm-hmm. that kids need right. to snack, right? Right. And there are certainly countries and cultures and other times in our own country when snacking wasn't considered a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with snacking is that when we talk about it in the abstract, like you and I are talking about it now, we all get this rosy picture of snacks. Oh, they're snacking on fruits and vegetables and they're having healthy little meals. And mm-hmm. But the research shows that kids are most likely to snack on salty snacks like chips and pretzels, and we get that started at the get-go with those mm-hmm. fish, you yep. know, shaped crackers, and they're drinking sweetened beverages and eating cookies, and that's what a snack is most yep. likely to consist of. So,
and societally, we really reinforce that behavior. It's like, you know, from daycare on, you know, it's really part of our culture.
Yes, and it doesn't have to be. The other thing is that constant snacking first of all, it's over, you know, it's overeating and more calories than you need just by the practice of snacking. Second of all, the snacking habit teaches kids the idea that any hunger at all is awful.
Yes, yes.
And that temporary
hunger.
That it
is some sort of a terrible distress and emergency that has to be addressed.
Better to eat Doritos than be hungry for 20 minutes, you know, as opposed to, oh, okay, well, hunger is building a good appetite. You're going to have a great meal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a mindset that, oh, I should never be hungry. So that's a second kind of problem associated with overeating.
Mm-hmm.
A third kind of problem associated with overeating is driven by parents who tell kids that if you want your dessert, you have to finish your food.
Mm-hmm.
Because what that teaches kids is, I really wanted to stop because I'm kind of full. But mom says if I want to have my brownie, I have to eat my mm-hmm. broccoli. Okay, I'll eat my broccoli because I really want the brownie. Mm-hmm. Now I'm really full. And who passes up a brownie just because they're full?
That's right.
It's like, please raise your hand if you're that one person so we can identify you. And so... So that's the third reason the kids are being taught to eat dessert when they're already full, right? So that becomes the norm. And then the other reason is that we come along as parents and we feel like it'll make us feel better. We're having trouble influencing what our kids eat so much, so we make them always eat 2 or 3 more bites. I've had parents tell mm-hmm. me that whatever's left on the plate, they split it in half yeah. and make their kids eat that.
It's the clean plate club. And that's really, you know, part of the problem in this country is that, you know, we have bigger and bigger portions, bigger and bigger plate sizes. And, you know, people are starving in Europe. That's what they used to tell us when
right.
when I was growing up. I guess
right,
they're not starving
exactly.
in Europe anymore. They're starving somewhere. But
that's right.
They'll always be
that's
starving
right.
somewhere.
That's right. And so So that practice of telling kids to eat what's on their plate, right, teaches them to look for external signs of fullness. So that's a different problem of overeating. And then at the very end, there's the problem of the child who is not really able to distinguish when they're really full, you know.
Which is important to learn. It's important to learn about that.
Yes, because we think that it comes naturally, but some kids really can't do that, especially when parents have been interfering by making them eat a few more bites. And then, of course, there's always the problem of the forbidden fruit, and as soon as you get your hands on some snacks that you haven't been allowed to eat, you gorge on. So when we talk about overeating and overweight in America, we can't lump all those reasons together, because the solution, the generic solution, is the same. We have to work with our kids to teach them the skills that they need to figure out how to manage their diets. But the actual skills that they would need to learn in each of those situations is different. And parents also have to become highly conscious of the lessons that they're inadvertently teaching.
Okay. Well, this is a good point in which to pause, because I want to get into some practical solutions. They come to us from your book, which is It's Not About Broccoli. the three habits to teach your kids for a lifetime of healthy eating. And also, you were kind enough to send me a Superfood Explorer kit, and we'll do a deep dive on that, because that's almost like a little science fair project you can do with your kids about food that'll change the way that they approach eating. All that in part two with today's guest, Dr. Dina Rose. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.